been a great schoolwork for us, a supporter, and has been the Chinese Study Center. We're co-sponsoring this with us, this event. Rick, people here undoubtedly know, has been working on Chinese politics, Chinese international politics for a long time. He has, among his books, are Reform and Reaction in Post-Mao China, The Road to Tiananmen, Burying Mao, Chinese Politics in the Age of Deng Xiaoping, and most recently, pretty good title, Confessions of a Peking Tom, University of Washington Press, hot off the press, just out now. They're available, right?
Next week.
They're available now. So, Rick wanted me to let you know that he's just completed videotaping a 48 lecture series on the rise of China for the Great Courses series produced by the teaching company. So, where can we see that if we want to see it?
In May.
In May. Okay. Thanks very much, Rick.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. First, let me apologize to those of you who thought you were coming here to see the 1983 film with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. This is not that film.
Oh, why did you have to tell them?
They would have figured it out soon enough. Early in 1996, which was a pivotal year in U.S.-China relations, China test-fired missiles, unarmed missiles, into the Taiwan Strait, very close to the island of Taiwan. The United States responded by sending two aircraft carrier groups to the area as a reminder, gentle or not so gentle, of just who controlled that part of the Pacific. China backed down, ceased the missile tests, but the incident touched off some very strong reactions in Beijing. First, there was a pronounced revival of nationalist sentiment in China, which had been laying more or less dormant for some years. It became even more strident a couple of years later after the accidental U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. Between 1996 and 1999, a number of books with breathless titles began appearing on bookshelves and in bookstores in China, proclaiming China's unwillingness to be bullied by the United States any longer. The first of these many books was China Can Say No, Zhongguo Kei Shuo Bu. And then, following the Belgrade embassy bombing, two more snazzy titles, America's Evil Plots, Meiguo Yinmo, and Zhongguo Buka Ru, China Cannot Be Intimidated. And then the final book in this surge of anti-American books was called, a few years later, China Can Still Say No, Zhongguo Haishi Kei Shuo Bu. There was a general sense in China of rising nationalism. It was palpable. I experienced it myself in the summer of 1999. I was on vacation at Yellow Mountain in China, Huangshan, wearing a T-shirt with a UC, University of California, logo on it. And an elderly woman, about 4 feet tall and at least 70 years old, came up to me and stuck her finger in my chest and said, "You Americans, when we're stronger, you're not going to be able to bully us anymore." Wow, that was really quite an experience. I had nothing to say. I was speechless. Another effect that was visible and palpable in the wake of the 1996 missile crisis was an upsurge of Chinese strategic interest in assaying the determinants of what they called comprehensive national power, CNP, in Chinese, Zhonghe Guoli. In the late 1990s, from 1996 to the end of the decade, Chinese think tanks began to scientifically study the components of CNP, Comprehensive National Policy, and began making predictions and projections about future trajectories involving both China and other major powers in the world. The first results, the initial results of this effort to scientize prediction about national power, were interesting but far from compelling. In one civilian study undertaken by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, 10 components of CNP were listed, including natural resources, domestic economic capability, foreign economic capability, S&T capability, military capability, social development level, government regulation, regulatory and control capability, and diplomatic capability. These indicators, each indicator in turn, was broken down into specific subcomponents. Social development included, for example, demographic distribution, educational levels, healthcare delivery, and so on. The indicators were weighted differentially according to some rather vague and murky criteria, which were never fully elaborated. With the civilian Social Science Academy project, heavily weighted domestic economic capability as its number one component, followed by S&T capability, social development, and only in fourth place, military capability, an interesting rank ordering. Now, at almost the same time that the CAS estimates were being produced and published, a second assessment of comparative CNP was undertaken by a Chinese military think tank, using a rather different set of criteria and also weighing the individual components differently. Not surprisingly, the military estimates gave greater weight to military and technological factors. In fact, these were ranked 1 and 2, while discounting social development, government regulatory capacity, and diplomacy. Hard power versus soft power, you might say. Now, as far as what they found, the civilian assessment projected the following trend. Based on mid-1990s data, CAS predicted that between 2000 and 2020, U.S. CNP would decline relative to Japan, Germany, and China, with Japan actually overtaking the United States by 2015. By 2020, China would rise from 10th position to 7th, but would lag well behind the major Western powers and Japan. Now, in partial explanation of this finding, CAS relied substantially, though not entirely, on per capita statistical data, which meant that China's position vis-a-vis the U.S. was downgraded, rather than aggregate data they used per capita. Economic and other social developmental data. By contrast, the military study relied more on gross aggregate data. The number one spot, their number one spot in 2020, was occupied still by the United States, followed by China as number two, Germany number three, and Japan number four. Aside from China, the other big gainers in the military projection were Brazil and India, rising to number 7 and number 5, respectively. Among the conspicuous losers were projected France and England, each one of which fell 2 slots to number 6 and number 8, respectively. Now, a more recent study of CNP, published in 2006 by a leading civilian think tank, not the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, yielded the following comprehensive power index for the 10 top countries using 4 main criteria: human resources, economic capacity, military capacity, and energy consumption, using combined per capita and aggregate data. Their results are really difficult to understand or comprehend. They have the United States first with an index of number of 91, the United Kingdom second with an index of 65, Russia third at 63, France fourth at 62, Germany tied with France also at 62, and China in sixth place with 59, followed by Japan, Canada, South Korea, and India. A really strange set of rankings. The point of all of this is not that you can't do this kind of exercise, but the wide discrepancies among these allegedly scientific and statistically sophisticated projects. It suggests that extreme caution needs to be exercised before placing too much faith in predictions of just when or if China is getting ready to eat America's lunch. Now, in this connection, it would be remiss not to talk about American predictions and projections. But the Americans, at least in the last decade, American analysts, military and civilian, have tended to shy away from using constructing numerical indices. And the reason for this is not terribly hard to find. It was stated rather succinctly by Ashley Tellis in 2000 in an attempt to analyze national power, which was undertaken by the RAND Corporation. The most significant finding of the Tellis group was, and I quote here, "Exercises in rank ordering may not indicate very much about what makes countries really powerful. Such exercises point to how countries compare against one another by some gross measures, but they are not grounded in a clear understanding of what makes certain nations powerful or why some nations can be said to have more power than others. Further, in focusing on rank ordering to the neglect of almost all else, the traditional approaches to measuring power offered an extensive rather than intensive picture, one that depicts the global distribution of capabilities but does not enable a close and detailed scrutiny of any specific target country. The key limitation of the traditional approaches, therefore, is not that they are wrong, but that their methodology is inappropriate for intensively investigating the national power of a few candidate great powers." That said, we still want to know where the U.S. and China stand relative to one another, and where they are likely to stand 10, 20, 50 years from now. We all know about the intersecting lines. China's growth looking like this and America's growth looking like this, and the question is, when do those lines intersect? Are we headed toward a new bipolar world condominium, as some suggest, most recently Neil Ferguson, who dubbed this G2 as Chimerica? And if so, will the marriage turn out to be a happy one or an acrimonious one? Ferguson himself, Ferguson himself thought it would end in acrimony. But another rather well-known book by economist Zach Carabel, in the book called Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy, foresees a long-term symbiosis and a strong attachment between the two. Alternatively, will China incorporate it, replace the United States as the world's sole and dominant hyperpower, while the U.S. continues its putative slide into economic decline and civilizational decay? This is the thesis of Martin Jacques in his recent book, When China Rules the World, just one of many journalistic books that excel in hyperventilation. By contrast, might the remarkable Chinese rise of the past 25 years begin to falter and founder on the shoals of unbalanced economic growth, rapidly inflating asset bubble, rampant income polarization, ubiquitous official corruption, and declining Communist Party legitimacy? Such a blunt prediction of Chinese decline and even collapse was predicted a decade ago in Gordon Chang's also breathless book, The Coming Collapse of China. Most recently, a more modest and moderate incarnation of this viewpoint appears in Susan Shirk's book, China, Fragile Superpower, with the emphasis on the fragility. Finally, might an increasingly unified Europe, a resurgent Russia, a leaner, meaner Japan, might any one or all of these countries offer potential counterweight to the United States and China, creating an effective balance of power? This would be the default position of classical power balance school of IR theory, as championed by Henry Kissinger and others. And what of the relationship between China and the United States, assuming they don't marry and become Chimerica? Will the pessimistic forecasts of offensive realists like Jonathan Mearsheimer prove prescient, with increasing friction between the rising power and the established one leading to inevitable confrontation and conflict? Or will the optimistic predictions of neoliberal internationalists prevail, with China's progressive economic modernization, globalization, and multilateral engagement serving to pluralize the Chinese polity and blunt the sharp edges of virulent Chinese nationalism? Now, we're obviously confronted with a broad array of possible futures. So how do we cut through all the hype and hyperventilation to arrive at a reasonable assessment or set of assessments about China's future place in the international system? First, it has to be said that China's rise over the past 25 years has been nothing less than spectacular. By almost any indicator, GDP, human development, military power, resource consumption, and even outbound FDI, foreign direct investment, China is gaining fast on the world's leaders. This remarkable development was dramatically accelerated and facilitated by a series of brilliant strategic choices made by Deng Xiaoping at the outset of the Age of Reform. First, Deng made peace with the United States. All else, he felt, depended upon a peaceful international environment. Second, Deng opened the Chinese economy to foreign trade, investment, technology, tourism, and management. The idea was to catch up as quickly as possible with the best world standards in all of those. Third, Deng turned his back on the orthodox command economy of socialism, turning instead to market principles to generate competition and growth. It worked brilliantly. And he did so not by using shock tactics or a big bang tactic, but by introducing reforms gradually on a trial and error basis, as he put it, crossing the river by groping for stones. This was in contrast, of course, to the tactics adopted in the Soviet Union and much of Eastern and Central Europe. What did I say? Did I say Jiang Zemin? Yes, I certainly did mean Deng Xiaoping. Sorry about that. Okay. Fourth, Deng indefinitely postponed basic political reforms in the belief, first, that rapid economic growth would diminish the likelihood of political unrest, and second, that political stability, along with peace with America, was a fundamental requisite for successful rapid modernization. These beliefs have been generally validated over the past 30 years. And finally, in the later 1980s, Deng issued his famous 20-character instruction, enjoining his successors in dealing with international affairs to, as he put it, observe development soberly, meet challenges calmly, conceal our capacities, bide our time, remain free of ambition, and never claim leadership. This is known generically as Pao Guangyan Hui. Bide time, conceal capability. But that's a really distorted summary of the whole thing, because just as important is the idea of remaining free of ambition and never claiming leadership. This terse admonition to Deng's would-be and future successors was later joined to an official Chinese government slogan that stressed China's unwavering devotion to the principle of peaceful development. These various policy innovations, both declamatory and concrete, served the cause of China's modernization extremely well, enabling the country to develop its economy and even its military capacity without fueling excessive international concern and without provoking an active response of containment from the United States and its allies. Because of China's remarkable record of sustained double-digit growth, several recent studies have predicted that else equal China is likely to surpass the U.S. in total GDP within 10 or perhaps at most 20 years, depending on whether PPP or nominal exchange rates are used in the calculation, and depending also on whether low-end or high-end growth projections and estimates are used. I'll happily leave the details of this and the inevitable controversy over how these things are derived to my colleague, Barry Nunn. Now, in terms of per capita GDP, one thing that stands out is that the gap between the two countries remains massive, currently standing at approximately 17 to 1 in per capita GDP. Overcoming this gap is likely to take, in the view of many economists, the better part of the current century. As for military power, recent estimates give the United States approximately a 15 to 20 year lead over China in terms of its capacity to project military power on a global scale. Now, this doesn't mean that they'll catch up in 20 years, because these are moving targets. So the catch-up rate will be a bit slower. China currently lags far behind the United States in terms of nuclear warheads, long-range missiles, blue water naval capacity, nuclear submarines, reconnaissance capabilities, robotics, and most other measures of raw military power, hard power. Currently, the United States spends 7 times as much on national defense as China, roughly $600 billion to $85 billion, though there is a good bit of controversy over the actual significance of this, since there are substantial expenditures on both sides that are either off the books or hidden in civilian budgets. So the actual figures on both sides are actually greater, proportionally probably greater on the Chinese side. In terms of non-conventional military capability, or what is sometimes called asymmetrical warfare, including such things as signal jamming, computer hacking, and denial of service attacks, China has already demonstrated unusual sophistication, as demonstrated by successful hacking attacks against Department of Defense and other strategically located U.S. and foreign computer networks. Today, there are said to be several hundred thousand Chinese hackers actively engaged in learning these skills, both amateur and professional, civilian and military. And there are even specialized hacking academies where specialists in electronic warfare are trained. One of the more interesting books to come out recently is called Unrestricted Warfare, China's Master Plan to Destroy America. And a lot of this is about China's emerging electronic warfare capability. That's what they generally mean when they talk about asymmetrical warfare. Now, in terms of regional or theater military capacity, the picture looks rather different. Because China has an impressive arsenal of short and medium range ballistic missiles, at least 1,100 of which are currently aimed at Taiwan. They also have a growing fleet of submarines for coastal defense, and a small to medium-sized naval force capable of just moving into blue water, although not crossing it. Moreover, they have late-generation jet fighters, which are increasingly believed to be capable of sinking American aircraft carriers. And in that respect, the Chinese arsenal, as it is now arrayed in the Western Pacific, is capable of rapidly altering the balance of forces in that region. According to some Pentagon estimates, China, within the next 3 to 5 years, will have the capacity to neutralize the American advantage long enjoyed in aircraft carriers and carrier-based jet fighters in and around the East China Sea. When that happens, the U.S. may no longer be able effectively to deter, or if deterrence fails, to defeat a Chinese attack on Taiwan without resorting to nuclear brinksmanship, a step regarded by many analysts as politically untenable in this particular day and age. Now, turning to energy use, the United States currently consumes just 5% more electricity than China, roughly 3.8 billion megawatt hours to 3.6 billion megawatt hours. But again, on a per capita basis, the differences are striking. There is a massive American lead in energy consumption. But this gap, like so many others, is expected to continue to diminish over time, even as China's greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise dramatically. Finally, in terms of human resources, the latest UNDP Index of Human Development, published in 2009, which includes measures such as life expectancy, literacy, years of education, and standard of living, the United States ranked 13th in the world, down one slot from the previous survey, while China ranked 97th, up seven slots from the previous survey. So China is moving up through the ranks on human development. The United States is dropping slowly back. Okay, so what's the takeaway from all of this? What do we do with it all? First, based on an intuitive assimilation of all these various data and projections, it seems likely that America's global lunch will not be eaten by China for at least 30 years, give or take, depending on rates of growth, depending on exogenous interference and so on, unknown and unpredictable forces. But these present trends may not continue as China faces increasing international and domestic constraints on its remarkable economic record of economic growth. And most economists expect a slowdown to a level of 7 to 8% as a reasonable expectation within the next several years. Now, it should be added that after China's economy declined in 2008 because of the global recession to roughly 6.8% growth, it shot up again to 8.7, was it last year? So they recovered more quickly and more comprehensively than we certainly have. But anyway, again, I'll leave the consideration of the implications of that to Barry. Now, any significant slowdown in Chinese growth, triggered, for example, by rising domestic instability, could deal a substantial blow to China's aspirations of early global parity with the United States, much as Japan's global financial implosion in the 1990s dramatically weakened that country's international footprint. So these kinds of things are obviously unpredictable. Cass predicted that Japan would surpass the United States by 2015. If you haven't been noticing, then that's not going to happen. Fourth, or next, this possibility of China's growth being limited by factors beyond anybody's ability to predict or control affords small comfort to us. Because within the next decade, most likely, China's growing regional military power will, as indicated already, enable the PRC to begin to successfully contest U.S. strategic dominance in Asia. And that's the important playing field for China. Not the Middle East, not even Africa or Latin America. It is Asia. And it's a mistake to argue that China needs global military parity to effectively challenge U.S. regional interests in Asia. As China's presence, both diplomatic, economic, and military, in the region continues to grow, Asia's longstanding Pax Americana will almost certainly become untenable. Meanwhile, as the Chinese footprint expands in Asia, conventional assumptions about America's willingness to pay the rising costs of continued strategic dominance in the region will become more problematic. China's ascension in Asia will almost, for example, almost certainly make Japan, India, and Vietnam, among others, increasingly nervous and looking to alternative sources of security. And this, in turn, will most likely increase regional tensions as America faces the very real prospect of downsizing its commitments there. Meanwhile, the countries of ASEAN, especially the large countries, Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia, will increasingly be constrained to adapt and accommodate to China's regional interests and power capacity. When we try to foresee the specific implications of this power shift in Asia, we run headlong into the central unknown once again, the China in the China rising equation. Namely, what role will an increasingly powerful, increasingly self-confident China play in the emerging regional and global order? To paraphrase the title of a conference that will be held here at UCLA in May, will China be a responsible stakeholder in the global community or a revisionist superpower pressing for fundamental, far-reaching changes in the existing order? Broadly speaking, there are two main schools of thought on this question, neorealism and neoliberal internationalism. There are others, but I'm going to try to subsume those under these two broader rubrics. Neoliberals generally believe that the frictions generated when a rising power begins to rub up against an established one can and often are mitigated by other forces, most notably the multifaceted centripetal forces exerted by the process of globalization itself. This is the essence of Thomas Friedman's famous Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention. As he put it, when a country reaches the level of economic development where it has a middle class big enough to support a McDonald's network, it becomes a McDonald's country. And people in McDonald's countries don't like to fight wars. They prefer to wait in line for hamburgers. Now, while this is clearly intended as a heuristic caricature, it nonetheless contains a substantial grain of truth. I've only been able to find one nominal exception to the Golden Arches theory, and even that may not hold up, and that would be Hamas's deadly exchanges with Israel in Gaza. There may be others, but I wasn't able to find them in a long list of international conflicts that I looked at. In Afghanistan, when the U.S. went into Iraq, were there McDonald's there? And No, it has to be both countries. No, there's no question that countries with McDonald's will make war on it. In the case of China, it's clear that China's rise has been marked by greater openness to foreign trade, we've remarked on that already, investment, tourism, and even culture to a limited extent. It's also been marked by greater participation in international markets and in international financial and commercial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, WTO, etc. By greater adherence also to international legal norms and diplomatic conventions, by greater involvement with global anti-terrorist, anti-drug, and anti-nuclear proliferation efforts, by a greater proclivity to enter into border negotiations with adversarial neighbors, and by greater sensitivity to the need for building consensus in international diplomacy. In each of these respects, China has moved far in the direction of becoming a responsible stakeholder. But there is another conflictual aspect to China's rise. Unlike neoliberals, realists see frictional conflicts of national interests inevitably growing as an emerging dissatisfied power seeks greater international space and security vis-a-vis the dominant established power or powers. Realists of all stripes, both offensive and defensive, point to certain recent international events to bolster their contention of an increasing Chinese challenge to America's hegemonic interests and to a rising American tendency to resist such challenges. A short list of such current points of tension would include the following. First, the angry Chinese response to the sale of $6.5 billion worth of U.S. arms to Taiwan announced only recently. The items for sale included Patriot missiles, Black Hawk helicopters, and mine-hunting ships, among other things. China reacted to this announcement by canceling a number of scheduled military exchanges and implying that there would be further, even more destructive consequences. An equally angry Chinese response was made to President Obama's recent White House meeting with the Dalai Lama, to which China responded by threatening, quote, severe consequences. The United States has displayed, on its part, rising unhappiness with China's ostensibly amoral resource diplomacy in Africa and the Middle East. In the American view, China is turning a blind eye to gross human rights violations and political repression in such countries as Sudan, Congo, Zimbabwe, Iran, and Myanmar, among others, in order precisely to ensure its secure supplies of energy and mineral resources. In response to such criticism, China cites its long-standing bedrock commitment to the principles of mutual equality and non-intervention in the internal affairs of other countries. What they do in their country is their business. There have also been rising American pressures on China to revalue its currency, to make American exports more competitive, and to stanch the flow of lost American jobs, pressure that's increased in proportion to the severity of the recession. In a variation on the familiar retort, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, American pressures for currency revaluation have been increasingly met by blunt Chinese warnings about America's continued dependence upon China to finance its enormous national debt. A blunt reminder that Americans need to put their own house in order before they start insisting that China do the same. Last fall, U.S. trade sanctions were announced against China after a long period of threatening and implying that they were forthcoming. They actually did forthcome, designed to halt alleged market-disrupting surges in Chinese exports in such areas as tires, automobile tires, and rolled steel products. In a tit-for-tat response, Beijing threatened to apply its own sanctions against a broad range of American exports. In the face of mounting U.S. pressures for the United Nations to impose tough economic and military sanctions against Iran for violating its non-proliferation commitments, China has steadfastly refused to support the use of sanctions, stating a strong preference for conventional diplomacy over coercion. Next on the list of tension points is the ongoing Googlegate flap. When Google announced its intention to pull out of China recently because of allegations that China had originated cyber attacks targeting the Gmail accounts of Chinese human rights activists, China responded by alleging that the United States was engaged in online warfare by using, among other things, the internet to stir up unrest in Iran, of all places. At last December's Copenhagen Summit on Global Warming, China's top climate negotiator refused to accept the concept of mandatory greenhouse gas emission reductions, insisting instead that rich countries should bear the major costs of reducing greenhouse gases. And he accused the United States and other rich nations of hatching a conspiracy to divide the developing world on the issue of mandatory controls. In response, the State Department's climate change envoy sharply rejected the Chinese position and characterized the summit meeting as a, quote, snarling, aggravated, chaotic event, unquote. Toward the end of the Copenhagen conference, Chinese Premier Wang Jiabao appeared to deliberately stiff President Obama by skipping a high-level meeting with the president and instead sending a lower-ranking envoy in his place. Weighing the evidence in support of both the neoliberal and the neorealist positions on the security consequences of China's rise, in the final analysis, it would appear that at least since the latter part of 2009, we have begun to move away from the atmosphere of cooperation, consultation, and give and take that has generally characterized the U.S.-China relationship since September 11, 2001. And one of the precipitating factors in all of this was the publication of a new book, a collection of essays by academics, entitled China is Unhappy, Zhenguo Bugaoxing. And this book contains a number of indictments of, what are they unhappy with? They're unhappy with us, primarily. And they're unhappy for a variety of reasons that I've outlined in this talk. We seem to be moving in the last, it's only been 6 to 8 months that this has been happening, but it's been happening with some regularity. We seem to be moving toward a more edgy and prickly and contentious relationship, with much of the initiative coming from the Chinese side. There does, however, seem to be a distinct tide of frustration visible on the American side as well. This frustration has been exacerbated by rising Chinese impatience with America's putatively inadequate response to global recession, as well as by rising congressional pressures on President Obama to apply stronger punitive sanctions in order to bring about meaningful Chinese currency and trade concessions. So pressures are building on the American side even as they are building on the Chinese side. With Chinese self-confidence growing, with America seemingly mired in domestic political acrimony and immobilism, in the growing tide of mutual frustration could conceivably become transformed from the realm of temporary situational duress into more long-term, broad-based, and potentially self-reinforcing hostility and distrust. It's a possibility, not a given. Since last summer, the inflammatory nationalist impulses of the late 1990s have enjoyed something of a revival in China, as various PRC commentators, including the various contributors to this book, and including also a number of military authors who are for the first time beginning to publish in open sources. Many of these essays and articles have called for a firmer stand against American arrogance and American interventionism in the world. This time around, however, the nationalist resurgence is somewhat different. It's exhibited less raw emotional intensity and excitation than before. This time, China's prickly responses have been fueled by a growing sense of economic and strategic self-confidence, coming not from a sense of weakness and humiliation, but rather from strength, not from impotence, but from potency. Whether this represents a temporary aberration in China's approach to the United States or a more fundamental tipping point in Sino-American relations remains to be seen. Too soon to tell. But the signs are becoming more ominous. Ever since Deng Xiaoping's initiation of the policy of reform and opening in 1978, China has needed America's goodwill far more than we have needed theirs, a fact implicitly acknowledged in Deng's admonition to meet challenges calmly, bide our time, and remain free of ambition. And this, in turn, has undoubtedly impelled China's leaders, at least until most recently, to tone down their displays of assertive nationalism and international ambition. Though we cannot predict with certainty how the next generation of Chinese and American leaders will deal with rising frictions between the two countries, we can, at the very least, respond to the question posed by the title of this colloquium. Are the United States and China trading places? The clear answer is not yet, and not for a long while. But as I indicated earlier, we cannot take comfort from this, from any unwarranted complacency, for the more we tend to discount either the reality or the implications of China's seemingly inexorable rise toward parity, the more likely we are to find ourselves in a new Cold War with consequences that are currently unfathomable. What's the bottom line of all of this? Well, China is not poised to eat our lunch anytime soon. But it nonetheless seems like it would be a pretty good idea for the United States to invite China to the picnic table and to share with China a few potato chips, one or two Oreo cookies, but for now at least, our peanut butter sandwiches are safe. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ben.